This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. President Trump has postponed a decision on which countries will be subject to new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. As Becca Schimmel reports, regional industry leaders say they're disappointed by the delay.
Trump is expected to announce his decision on which countries will get permanent exemptions from the steel and aluminum tariffs next month. He's also expected to announce quotas for those that are exempted. Steel and iron industry representatives discussed the delay in a press briefing. John Ferriola is CEO and president of Nucor, a steel producer with facilities in Kentucky and Ohio. Ferriola says he's disappointed by the delay.
By opening it up for another month, what we're doing is giving these countries that have been dumping into our country another month to get their steel into the country before the tariffs or quotas go into effect.
Ferriola says he's pleased that the tariffs will eventually go into effect and that there will be no more extensions. Originally, Trump announced a 25% tariff for steel and 10% for aluminum. He then temporarily exempted the EU, Canada, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and South Korea.
You know, at the end of the day, if our words are to have meaning, we have to act on those. We have to follow through on the promises that we make to our industry and to our country, and we're counting on the president to do that.
Executive Vice President and COO of commercial metal company Tracy Porter was also at the press briefing. He says the continued diminishing of the manufacturing sector in the U.S. is a travesty, and he's proud of the president for stepping up and addressing unfair trade practices.
We, at the pace we're going, are going to be relegated to some third world country status probably in my children's lifetime if we do not stop it now. And unfair is unfair.
Economists warned that tariffs would also raise prices for U.S. businesses and consumers. According to a report by the Tax Foundation, the estimated negative effect on Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia businesses is more than $600,000 each year. In Kentucky alone, there are more than 200 steel, aluminum, and iron facilities. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
A new study finds that the epidemic of drug overdose deaths in the U.S. has led to an increase in organ donors. Despite the previous stigma attached to using organs from overdose donors, the study indicates that outcomes from related transplants are highly successful. Carol Lofton reports that in West Virginia, around a third of organs used in transplants are from overdose donors.
Vicki Keene desperately needs a lung transplant.
I'm at 15% with my lungs, so that means I could live 2 to 3 years with my lungs. I need lungs to survive.
Keene was a single mom and for 13 years worked at a coal yard shoveling coal and performing other duties that involved close contact with dust. 7 years ago, she was diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, more commonly known as COPD.
I have no life. Because you can't breathe, you can't move around. If my husband's not here to put my oxygen in the car, then I can't go anyway. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cry, but this disease just takes your life completely away from you.
There are more than 115,000 people waiting for an organ transplant in the U.S. It's difficult to know exactly how many West Virginians need a transplant because the state only has one transplant center for one organ, kidneys. Everyone else, like Keene, has to go out of state and is listed there. Dr. Joseph Africa is the program director of the Charleston Area Medical Center Transplant Program.
Probably close to a third of our deceased donor transplants from last year came from overdose donors. And then for this year alone, I think it's even higher. It may be two-thirds of our deceased donors.
The circumstances that allow a person to become an organ donor are fairly narrow. In West Virginia, donors need to die in a hospital and be declared brain dead or irreversibly stop breathing to be considered. According to the Center for Organ Recovery and Education, or CORE, only about 2% of all deaths worldwide can be organ donors. Caitlin Metz is the Community Outreach Coordinator for CORE.
So when somebody passes away of an overdose, just like any death that would result in brain death, the patient comes into the hospital, and over the course of a few days, there are various tests that are done that confirm that their brain has died and will never ever be healed.
At that point, the donors are also tested for infectious diseases such as hepatitis and HIV. Even with these tests, recipients have the option to refuse the organ and wait for one that doesn't come from an overdose donor. Dr. Africa again.
The possibility of transmitting infection is a big factor that discourages transplant centers from transplanting these organs in the past. But it turns out, especially with this recent study that came out from the Annals of Medicine, transmission rate really is very low. And those organs tend to come from younger donors, unfortunately. And so the quality of organs are really good and would benefit a patient on the list.
The benefits extend not only to the patients on the list, but to the donors' families as well, who often are able to find a sense of closure and redemption in their loved one's final act of saving others' lives.
My daughter's name's Nadia Zytek. She was born in March, I'm ready to grow already, sorry, 1980.
Hilda Halstead's daughter died 2 years ago. She remembers her as a headstrong young woman who loved horses, did well in school, had two sons, and yet struggled on and off with addiction.
Her problems with addiction started when she went to WVU to college. And this child went from having a 4.57 GPA to having a 0.5 GPA. And just running around with the wrong crowd.
Eventually, Zytek went into recovery, went to nursing school, and seemed to get her life back on track. Then it fell apart again.
I got a call, and I recognized the phone number as being the phone number for the ER at General Hospital, because I know it well. And I picked it up. And one of the nursing staff that knows me said, Hilda, I hate to tell you, but your daughter's here. She was brought in unresponsive.
Zytek never woke up. Core approached the family about the possibility of Zytek becoming an organ donor.
She was a perfect match for all eight major organs. They said that's about the second time that's happened in a 10-year period here. It's helped ease the pain somewhat, but you can tell it really hurts. Well, you don't get over it.
Halstead says she feels a sense of connection with the people who got Zytek's organs. Patients like Vicky Keene, who are waiting for life-saving transplants, say that any donor, whether they died from an overdose or not, is a hero. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine. The U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is the longest-standing war prison in our nation's history. Since the launch of the so-called War on Terror, about 800 men have been held there without legal process or restraint on interrogation. Some former detainees describe Gitmo as hell on earth and have spent years recovering from physical and mental scars sustained during internment. Some U.S. military guards are also struggling to make sense of experiences there. In a recent episode of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Us and Them podcast, host Trey Case spoke with former Guantanamo detainee Moaz Mbeg and his military guard, Albert Malizi.
The work that I was doing out there was to help to build this school essentially from scratch. And again, remember, this is at a time when the Taliban's in power, and the Taliban banned the education for females. So that was what I was involved in until, of course, the US-led invasion began and the bombing of Afghanistan.
America strikes back. Afghanistan is pounded with
the
bombs.
First wave, 50 Tomahawk cruise missiles, 25 warplanes off the aircraft carriers, B-52s, B-1s, and these two B-2 stealth
explosions
bombs.
And the rattle of anti-aircraft fire. That's been heard throughout
the... What led you to abandon the work in Afghanistan?
The U.S. bombardment, single-handedly, cruise missiles, carpet bombs, vacuum bombs, whatever you want to call them, the bombing campaign. And one thing's important. Before we saw the bombs drop, we saw leaflets drop. And these leaflets literally offered $5,000 bounty money for every person suspected to be Taliban or Al-Qaeda was handed over for.
But as those leaflets came down, I mean, were you aware at the time that you were possibly in danger?
It's hard to describe to anyone that at a point where you think that you're safe and then literally overnight everything changes. What had happened clearly is that many members of the Taliban's security police force or whatever it was decided to turn themselves over or were captured or sold over whatever they had. But in the midst of this, of course, there's ordinary people who don't know what's going on. And essentially, a large number of people, I think myself included to some degree, were handed over as a result of this hunt for foreigners. It was literally people were being hunted. You had to find ways to get out that wouldn't cross checkpoints that the Northern Alliance had taken over. So you had to pass through all of that. So it was an odyssey for me.
And you left Afghanistan. Did you go to Pakistan?
Yeah, we were living in Islamabad in the capital. And in the midst of all of this, a friend of mine called me and he said that the MI5 were asking about you. And so I told him that I am here. I gave him my address. I told him exactly where I am, my telephone number. I said, if they want to see me, they're most welcome to come. But tell them that this is a very volatile time. I wasn't afraid of meeting with them. My concern was people are being bombed and killed where I am. So anyway, literally within a week of me telling him that, they did come, but not in the way I expected. It was on the night of the 31st January 2002. There was a knock on my door. I opened the door at midnight precisely. A group of people stormed in, put a gun to my head, tasers crackling in the background, put me into the prone position, tied my hands behind my back with cuffs, cuffed my legs, and then put a hood over my head. That's the last vision I have of where my family were. That's the last thing my wife saw of me in that state. And they took me into the back of a vehicle and then drove me off to secret locations. And in the midst of all of that, two Americans who were driving the vehicle, one of them takes off the hood of my head, and he's dressed as a Pakistani. He's speaking in an American accent. He's white Caucasian. And he says that you can either answer our questions here or you can answer them in Guantanamo.
After 10 months at Bagram Air Base, Baig was taken to the Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba. It was early 2003. Baig was placed in solitary confinement at Camp Echo, where he would spend almost 2 years. Meanwhile, Corporal Albert Molisi had been called up and was sent off for 3 months of military police training at Camp Hunter Liggett in California in preparation for Guantanamo Bay. When you knew you were going to go to Guantanamo Bay, did you do anything to prepare?
Yeah, I actually bought a Quran and I read through the Quran here and there, the English version, to educate myself so I don't disrespect anyone. Like, you hear news before I went, oh, people were stepping on Qurans. That's not what to do. It's disrespectful. Of course, it doesn't matter what religious book you have in front of you. You don't destroy someone's only hope of getting out of a place like that. But I wanted to prepare myself due to the fact that when you go to another country, you kind of want to go and respect the people.
Just before going to Gitmo, Molisi and his fellow guards went through a month-long training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, where they learned how to deal with the detainees they were going to encounter.
We'll go to these theater-type rooms and watch videos. And while they were showing flashes of Bin Laden's face, while the planes are going into Twin Towers, playing like Metallica music, and you're sitting in this room and it's repetitive, and they're getting you worked up and hyped up. It's a breaking down system and trying to make you focus on hate, mistrust, and anger. And that's what they were doing to the soldiers.
Did it work on you?
I would say at first, yeah. And then I realized what the hell just happened, because you feel like you're in a room where you're being brainwashed.
So are you saying that the United States military put you through a training process that would amp up your hatred towards Bin Laden and the various people who had perpetrated the attacks on September 11th?
Yes, there's no doubt. And if anyone ever tells you different, they will be lying. It's true. It happened. I was there and I was disgusted. You ask us to go overseas to do something, and here we are doing something, and it's the most aggressive thing you can ever go through. Yes, you are a soldier. You were trained to be a soldier, but you didn't train to do this type of work or think you were going to get brainwashed by your own government, but it happens.
We've been listening to an excerpt from WVPB's Us and Them podcast episode, My Friend from Camp. To hear the rest of the story, look for the Us and Them podcast online. You can hear it at wvpublic.org, or you can tune in to West Virginia Public Broadcasting this Thursday night at 8. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.